Ray is a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Three things for you today. A new interview with Alice LoCicero talking about young people who fall prey to terrorist groups. We will conclude the interview we began yesterday on the morning show with Domingo Martinez talking about his latest memoir, My Heart is a Drunken Compass. And you will hear from the son of Louis Zamperini, that incredibly heroic figure who is at the heart of the film, Unbroken. You'll hear from his son, Luke. All that on today's morning show here on WGTD. It is almost eerie to think about how timely this next morning show interview is, because it concerns one of the most pressing fears that people around the globe are experiencing right now. The scourge of terrorism and the fact that terrorists can spring up in our own backyard. Although on sort of a wider canvas, we think of terrorism and terrorists and terrorist acts as something that primarily happens in other places, far from here, although by no means has that ever been exclusively true. But now we are seeing repeatedly this phenomenon in which someone who is born and raised right here in the United States of America will seemingly fall under the spell of extremists of one kind or another and actually will become terrorists. And the question arises of how does that happen, and is it possible to prevent that from happening in sort of a wider scope, but also when it comes to a particular person? Are there warning signs that we can be looking for if there is a troubled young person prone to develop in this alarming direction? There is a book which has just been published called Why Good Kids Turn into Deadly Terrorists. And it examines this very question. And this interview, of course, comes in the wake of the most recent example in which a young man in Ohio has been arrested, it appears, just as he was on the brink of trying to perpetrate a terrorist attack here in the United States on the U.S. Capitol. Somebody who, by all indications, was at least once upon a time a well-adjusted young man, a member of his school's wrestling team and so on, but turning to a life almost unimaginable for the rest of us. So there is this book called Why Good Kids Turn into Terrorists, and it's written by Dr. Alice LoCicero, a clinical and research psychologist from Cambridge, Massachusetts, a member of the core faculty at the Center for Multicultural Training and Psychology at Boston Medical Center, and ahead of that, chair of the Department of Social Sciences at Endicott College, also earlier in her career, a staff psychologist at Boston's Children's Hospital and a faculty member of Harvard Medical School. She has not only been interested in this particular topic that we talk about today, but has also been involved in crisis intervention, response to disaster, has met with and worked with young victims of trauma and disaster and violence in all kinds of different locales. And she responded to the frightening bombing of the Boston Marathon with a series of projects. Again, this new book is called Why Good Kids Turn into Deadly Terrorists, Deconstructing the Accused Boston Marathon Bombers and Others Like Them, published by Prager. And Dr. Alice LoCicero, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here, and I so appreciate your introduction. You touched on so many of the very important factors for us to think about here.
One of the things I'm really struck about in your background is the fact that you have this extensive experience of crisis intervention, of offering aid to people who have suffered from mass disasters and traumas of one kind or another. To what extent is there a significant, tangible connection between that work and this interest you have in young terrorists?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Is there a connection there?
There is absolutely a connection. I have worked with victims of mass disasters, whether it be natural disasters or human-caused disasters, over a long period of time. And here at Boston Medical Center, we've provided a lot of service in the immediate aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings and in an ongoing way to survivors and family members. And so I am so well aware of the staggering, long-term, horrible effects of such disasters. And so my mission is to try to figure out how to prevent them. And the first step in prevention from a scientific point of view is always knowing and knowledge of the situation. And so although some people would prefer, and that's certainly their right, to not think at all about the perpetrators, my thought is some of us really have to try to understand the perpetrators in order to prevent future such disasters.
Hmm. My wife and I were in Boston this past summer on the 4th of July, in and around the 4th of July holiday. And actually, just by pure chance, we happened to walk by the site of where that bomb went off, and saw the small, poignant memorial that that is still right there at the curbside. And and of course, there were Boston Strong T-shirts on sale everywhere, and every so often in conversations in restaurants and shops and so on, we would hear snatches of conversation in which that event was still being talked about. It was a really striking reminder that that on the one hand, life goes on, and on the other hand, when something as traumatic and frightening as that occurs, it remains in the air in all kinds of ways, both obvious and not so obvious.
Absolutely. It's very disruptive. Boston's done a fabulous job of resiliency. The Boston Strong concept really helps us to remember that we can as a city manage this. But it's a very hard, and of course much harder for some families than others. But Boston has risen so to the occasion. So many people have contributed so much in terms of support, often at great cost to themselves. So I know that the city is very committed to helping people whose lives were disrupted. And again, I think the next step is preventing and helping others to prevent similar situations.
I know that, you know, in many respects, what is often held up as hope for the future in a place like the Middle East is the fact that there is a younger generation. By no means can we paint with too broad a brush here, but nevertheless, in this younger generation, in many cases, we can point to people for whom the world looks very different than it looked to their parents or their grandparents, where maybe certain prejudices were in very much in place, and distrust perhaps bleeding into outright hatred of other people from other places. And there are such widespread signs of hope amongst a younger generation that to some extent are maybe starting to shake off some of those shackles of prejudice. But again, by no means, not all. There are also parts of members of this younger generation who buy into those prejudices and hatreds. And I guess that might be one place for us to start, is how do we understand and explain that difference within this young generation?
So we wanted to think about the young generation in the whole world, not just in one part of the world. One of the reasons we have to think about that is that terrorism is a tactic that is used in the perception of asymmetric conflict. So if someone is from a group that they feel is weaker or is not getting a fair shake in the world, that group is more likely to use terrorism as a tactic in order to get attention, in order to destabilize the enemy, etc. And it's not limited to the Middle East. It's not limited to Islam. My studies include studies in Sri Lanka, where I visited in 2007 when the civil war was still going on. That was a war for land and power between two groups. Really, it wasn't about religion, but if you wanted to look at the dominant religions of the two groups, one was Buddhist and the other was Hindu. If we think about the terrorism in the Northern Ireland area, that was Christian versus Christian. So we have to be careful not to simply think of terrorism as a Muslim or an Islam problem. It's really it's a tactic. And thinking about that tactic, we have to really understand then from the point of view, you're talking about what's the point of view of people, from the point of view of young people, what do they see? And trying to be cognitively aware of what the perspective is of a young person and what in the world would cause their perspective to think that the best thing they can do, the thing that they can do to cause a meaningful life and a meaningful death, is to be killing other people. And that's a real puzzle, and I understand, and that's the puzzle that drew me into this, is to try to understand how could kids think that? You know, who's recruiting them or brainwashing them, whatever term you want to use, into thinking that a meaningful life can be had by killing people.
Right. And I guess the point that I was trying to make, and I'm glad you made the point too, because my example happened to spring out of the Middle East, but I didn't really mean it to be tied to that part of the world. But the fact that in some ways it feels like when it comes to this younger generation, it shouldn't be as simple to brainwash someone, to get, you know, for instance, your own child to just fall lockstep with your own prejudices, because the rest of the world has a way of seeping into their worldview in a way that just wasn't possible 50 years ago. I mean,
yeah,
50 years ago, somebody in, you know, some relatively remote part of the world, they had no idea what the rest of the world was like, or that there are young people in other places that, you know, in so many ways are just like them. And so it seems like there are some members of this young generation who understand that and who have a wide world view, and then there are others for whom that does not seem to penetrate.
Yeah, we have there's a cost and benefit of that worldwide view, of course, and it depends on how that view is interpreted. You know, all of us aren't seeing the world objectively, and certainly not some of the younger people who have their own developmental process going on. They may be 15 or 17 years old. They have a tendency to see the world in certain ways. They have a tendency to be idealistic and altruistic and to think that they can change the world by an action, and also to be seeking meaning. And I would say that many of the kids who do get recruited, who do get made to think that, you know, think a certain way that causes them to believe they're doing a good thing by killing people, many of those kids are quite vulnerable. And I think that's part one. We really have to look at vulnerable kids, and then we have to look at recruitment. So at some point, you know, we have a kid who's quite vulnerable, whose worldview can be influenced by someone who's unscrupulous and uncaring. Generally speaking, the recruiters don't care about the kids they're recruiting. They make the kids think they care. They make them think, oh, this is, you know, you're special. We're picking you out. You're going to have a wonderfully meaningful life. You'll be celebrated by the world. Your family will be celebrated, and so on, and we're selecting you for this mission. Some kids self-select, and then they find somebody who will then tell them, well, here's your mission. But the idea is somehow conveyed to the kid that they're doing an important action. And there's the similarity is eerie around the world of with different groups and different recruiting matter and materials. And when we look at the Kouachi brothers in Paris, the parallels to the Tranaev brothers, and also parallels to other kids who've been recruited and engaged in terrorist actions, there's definitely a pattern emerging, and I'm not, you know, I'm not alone in this. There's several other researchers who are seeing a very similar pattern. So we start with a kid who may be actually a very good kid, one maybe better than average, is kind of altruistic, wants to do something important. Many of these kids start out thinking that they'd like to be a physician or a dentist or somebody who's in a caring profession. And then difficult things happen in their lives, and at the same time, supports fall away. And those two things are pretty important, both the difficult experiences and the supports falling away. And supports fall away for all kinds of different reasons. Psychologists who study adolescents will say that the highest risk factor for kids getting into difficulty is lack of parental attention. And it's not necessarily the parents' fault or they're not bad parents, but a lot of things happen that distract parents. So that's one risk factor. And then vulnerability for many different reasons. And then you have somebody coming in who, you know, really thinks that, wow, I can use this kid now. It's really predatory. And the recruiting materials are so sophisticated. So then you have, now obviously most kids, even at that point, aren't going to do something terrible, but a few do.
Right. And this is the dark side of the world that I was describing earlier, in which, I mean, because we're aware of the rest of the world, can't we all get along a little better? But it's also in that very same world then where you can have an organization in Yemen that connects with a young man in Ohio. In a way that was not possible 50 years ago.
Right. Or think of the three girls from Colorado who somehow found their way to being connected to somebody who was going to sponsor them to go to, I believe, Syria to fight with ISIS.
Hmm.
And luckily, in that case, their parents found out in time to stop them. They were already in the EU and on their way, but they were stopped and brought back. But yeah, so that's, and really the recruiting, you're right, recruiting videos are online, and they're really sophisticated. There's an ISIS video online, which I saw, which is based on Grand Theft Auto. That's a pretty appealing video for a lot of kids.
Hmm.
So the question then is, how do we intervene? How do we prevent it? And I think because of all the things we've been talking about, prevention has to start real early. It has to start in a universal way. It can't be that we pick out kids. Oh, this kid looks like they're going in the wrong direction. We should notice if kids look like going in the wrong direction, and we should bring them back to the mainstream. But I think that we really need to start prevention efforts very, very early and universally.
Mm.
And I think they have to start in the community. Right? I don't think they can start on a national level. I think every community is going to do their own project here. Cambridge is going to look pretty different from Grand Rapids or Orlando or Milwaukee. They're all going to look different. But so I think it has to be a concerned citizens in communities that look at this.
We're speaking with Dr. Alice LoCicero about her book, Why Good Kids Turn into Deadly Terrorists. So my understanding is that you have actually met with quite an array of either young terrorists or potential young terrorists from a number of different continents. I'm just wondering a little bit about how that came about and what the experience has been like to actually, I presume, sit face-to-face with some of these young people.
Yeah, more of the people that I have met have been connected with family members or have been formerly in terrorist organizations or are at risk of being recruited and interested perhaps in being recruited rather than to people who have actually already engaged in terrorist action. Some of my colleagues have done that. That's been their mission. That hasn't been my mission. My mission has been to try to figure out, why is this appealing to young kids? As I said, some of the people that I've talked to, it turned out, had already been in organizations that engage in terrorism and have gotten out. Some of them have been rescued. Some kids don't want to be rescued, but they are rescued anyway. That came about because of my interest. You know, following September 11th, many of us in the social science field said, well, how is this going to affect our careers? What are we going to do next? And students asked some really insightful questions around that time, and One of my doctoral students and I decided to work together on this project. We started the Society for Terrorism Research. We did some work on the fear of terrorism, which, by the way, is really crucial to think about in the U.S. because the fear of terrorism, you mentioned it earlier, it almost reaches hysterical proportions at a number of points. And we really have to try to tamp it down, not because we shouldn't be afraid or alert or wary, but because we need to be able to think rationally. When we're too scared, we can't do that. And so we need to be try to find that rational side of ourselves so that we can figure out, well, what can we do? We can't leave it all to the government. It just doesn't make sense. And we can't leave it all to law enforcement or the military. These are our kids, and we got to figure out how to help them. And I think the city of Cambridge did a lot, was really a good place for the Chernayev brothers, but at the point when they left the high school, especially the younger one, left the high school, left his community of peer support, left the community of faculty and coach support and so on, I think that was when he began to be at greater risk. And there were a couple of years followed that. A lot of things happened. His family was falling apart. Both parents moved back to Dagestan and so on. So this follows a predictable pattern. And the same with the Kawachi brothers. That follows a quite predictable pattern. And now that we see it, it's incumbent on us to do something. That's my feeling.
One of the specific points you make is that it is often a question of conflicting identities, and the fact that a young person maybe finds themselves in a place both literally and figuratively in which they don't know exactly who they are or who they are supposed to be, particularly when it relates to this matter of identity. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. And I think thank you for pointing that out. And I think that's one of the reasons why this age group is particularly vulnerable, because this is a time, I mean, at many times in our lives, but especially at this time, people are thinking, you know, who am I? Who am I going to be? What am I going to be dedicated to? What's my mission in life? And yes, we find many kids, and the two examples that probably stand out in the book, but there are many others, are a young man from Norway and the young Chernayev brother, both of whom had immigrated to a Western country at about age 8 or 9 and had seemed to fit in. They were seen as, they were liked, well-liked. I think what happens in that case sometimes, often from kids that I've talked to, is in order to fit in, they don't really want to talk about their past. They don't even want to remember their past. But it doesn't go away just because you don't think about it or you don't talk about it. And at some point in adolescence, kids want to integrate that past in some way, want to integrate who they are and the various identities. And that would be a wonderful time for people to be able to listen really hard to what kids are talking about and draw them out. Although I do think prevention efforts happen earlier, but I think, you know, when kids are in that time, it's a good idea to let them talk, let's listen to them. And when they see that their new host country, right, the country that they've come to, which has given them so much, is also in conflict with some group that they identify with. And that's a perception. It may not be true. Like in the U.S., when presidents and leaders say, we are not fighting Islam, that works. People get that. When that doesn't happen, or if people don't hear it, kids don't hear it, and if they have somebody, you know, talking in their ear saying, oh, the U.S. is at war with Islam, then you have some troubles going on, especially for someone who may identify as Muslim. So, and as I said, this is the same pattern, whether it's Muslim, whether it's Hindu, whether it's whatever it is. So that's a point of vulnerability. When kids are trying to figure out who they are, they feel like two parts of themselves are identified with groups that are in conflict. And then somebody comes in and takes advantage of that difficulty that they're having. And if there's nobody that they can trust to go to who they can talk through the real legitimate grievances and maybe not so legitimate grievances that they have and who they can trust, they're left to the devices of the people who don't have their best interests at heart, who really want them as sort of fodder in their war.
Two quick questions to finish. We've already touched on the fact that this does not just involve young men, not just boys.
Yep.
But,
absolutely,
of course, it seems to involve many more boys than it does young girls. Do you have any sense of why that might be? Are there particular vulnerabilities that we so often find in boys rather than girls that would explain that?
I don't think so, because if we look at different groups, some of them are much more equal in terms of gender than others. So the Tamil Tigers, for example, which is a group that I studied in Sri Lanka, they were very egalitarian. There are a lot of girls in that group. So I'm not sure that it's inherent universally in human nature. It may be more of a cultural reason for selection.
The concern that you've already raised, that I think is a good point for us to finish with, is the fact that someone could conceivably take some of what we've talked about or some of what is in your book and in a sense be looking at every immigrant around them who dresses a little differently or has different colored skin or appearance of being from some other place, and particularly if they're young, and sort of having this fear that there's a potential terrorist standing in front of me. And I know that is in no way the intention of any of this. But what would your suggestion be for someone who maybe at least in sort of the deepest recesses of their being find themselves prey to those kind of uneasy fears?
Unfortunately, we see that already. I don't think that my book's creating it by any means. I think that's part of the problem, is that an awful lot of people, including some people who are in authoritative positions where we have profiling that's stated and publicly acknowledged. So I think that is a problem, and I don't think my book's causing it, but yes,
of course.
Question. My goal, of course, is to reduce the prejudice against young people who may be immigrants at the same time that we reduce potential terrorism. And I think the early prevention, the listening, and I think as people work on this as a group in a community, I think they'll begin to look at, well, what do we need to know? What legitimate grievances do these kids have? And are there things that we should be doing as a community to counter some of the things that kids are seeing that we're kind of seeing, but we don't really think they're that important? They look important to the kids. Maybe we need to talk to kids about that and help them to find ways to counter some of the things that they don't like, that we also agree we'd probably be better off without.
The book is Why Good Kids Turn Into Deadly Terrorists, Deconstructing the Accused Boston Marathon Bombers and Others Like Them, published by Prager, the author, Dr. Alice LoCicero. Dr. LoCicero, I thank you so much for your good, important work and for this fascinating book. I'm glad we got to talk.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Nearly the whole world knows the name of Louis Zamperini, the subject of the recent film Unbroken and the best-selling book by Laura Hildebrandt of the same name. And recently a new book has been released, which was written by Louis Zamperini himself not long before his death, called Don't Give Up, Don't Give In, Lessons from an Extraordinary Life, in which he recounts his experiences as something of a juvenile delinquent, the redemption he found as a superb runner, and then his heroic endurance through World War II in a Japanese concentration camp. I recently had the opportunity to ask his son, Luke Zamperini, what it was like to have such a heroic figure for a father.
Well, first of all, he was my hero because he was my father, first and foremost. And and he was just it was a wonderful dad. I mean, he was just always there for us. So he was a great dad. It's true. He felt that heroes were the guys that didn't come home or the guys that came home with parts of their bodies missing. And, but I would also say that, like him, guys that come home with part of their soul missing, guys that come home with post-traumatic stress disorder, they're walking away with scars that are sometimes even worse than the ones that are gotten physically in battle. So, in that regard, I still consider him a hero, even though he doesn't consider himself one.
One of the points he makes in the book is talking actually at great length about the great joy he experienced in working with young people, and in particular working with so-called juvenile delinquents. That's what he refers to them. And it sounds like he was very good at that work and that it gave him tremendous satisfaction. But I think a lot of us looking at your father's life wouldn't necessarily add those pieces together, that who he was and then what he experienced would necessarily naturally flow into then this life of working with young men in various states of difficulty themselves. What do you think drew him into that work and made him so successful with it?
Well, you know, one, he could relate to them because he was a juvenile delinquent himself before he discovered athletics. And, you know, when he came home from the war, you know, he'd spent 47 days adrift, 27 months in the Japanese prison camps. He came home with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it really took a toll on him. He was having the same nightmare every night of being attacked by the most heinous guard at camp, the one known as the Bird. And in his dreams, he was always trying to throttle the life out of the Bird. And, you know, he tried self-medicating with alcohol. He just got into fistfights at the drop of a hat. Life was really falling apart for this man who, to this point, was unbroken. And so he found himself in a Billy Graham tent meeting in 1949 in downtown Los Angeles, and it changed his life. He heard the message of forgiveness with faith in Jesus Christ, and he went back to the prayer room behind the stage there, and he got on his knees, and he realized that he'd made all these promises to God. If he would get him home from his war experience, he'd serve him. And he hadn't made good on that. So when he got off his knees, he realized that he was done getting drunk, and that he was done fighting, and that he'd forgiven all of his prison guards, including the Bird. And he went home that night. He never had that nightmare again for the rest of his life. And so then there's the feeling of giving back some. Well, he went back to Japan in 1950 and physically forgave his prison guards, came home to California, and thought, well, what's next? So he decided that he could help other kids that were in trouble like he was from his experiences. So he formed Victory Boys Camp, a nonprofit organization to help wayward kids find direction in their lives based on Christian teachings. And the methodology that he chose was to take these kids out of reform school, take them up into the High Sierras, and teach them outdoor skills. And like, you know, the first thing he'd do is he'd throw a rope around a tree and rappel down the side of a granite edifice. And then he'd tell these kids, you know, before the week is out, each one of you is going to do that. And so he would use these things that he would teach them as a way for them to get a sense of accomplishment once they actually performed, which helped build self-respect for them, which is something that he knew was lacking in his life when he was a juvenile delinquent.
Mm. And yeah, in fact, that theme of enriched self-esteem is a very, very powerful theme in the whole first part of this book. And it's really kind of disarming in one of the first chapters when we read the words, "I was a rotten kid."
Yeah.
I mean, he just says it as flatly as that. And of course, then he goes on to describe his escapades, and that maybe wasn't too far off. But of course, he finds redemption in running, so much so through his older brother, who made all the difference in the world, of course. Back to your own relationship with your father for a moment. To what extent did you ever travel the same path as a young person, or by and large, was your childhood just night and day from what your father experienced? I don't mean any of the nightmare of the war, but that first really difficult personal path in which finally he found redemption on the racetrack. Is your own story at all an echo of your father, or in a sense, was he able to provide you with a very different kind of childhood?
Well, I was a handful as a young man as well. My mother used to go to her mother-in-law and express frustration. "I just don't know what to do with Luke. He's such a troublemaker." And so Grandma would say, "Are you kidding? He was an angel compared to his dad." So I was a little bit better than him. And, I didn't need 47 days in a life raft and 27 months in a prison camp to turn me around. I basically had eventually learned from my father's experience and decided that was no lifestyle to have. And then, indeed, my son, who's now 28 and who is now the CEO of Victory Boys Camp, He was even less of a rascal than I was. So we're getting better generationally.
Very good. As you look back on your father and of course, what he describes, he was able at so many points in the heart of the darkest nightmare to make choices that for the rest of us probably might feel like all but impossible choices to make in terms of trying to count his blessings, choosing as positive an attitude as possible, even when floating on the Pacific Ocean on a life raft or in imprisonment to look for hope and look for humor and so on. How do you think it was possible for your father to make the kind of life-changing choices that he was able to make in the midst of such suffering, which he describes so well in this book?
Well, he was a very prepared person. You know, when his plane crashed in the ocean, he was ready for the challenge. He had, you know, he was an Eagle Scout as a kid, so he learned a lot of things about, you know, survival outdoors. You know, he knew that bullets would lose their velocity in about 3 feet of water. In college, he studied physiology, so he knew that the human brain was like a muscle, and if you didn't use it, it would atrophy. And he even took a course in survival at sea during World War II, and in particular, surviving in the water with sharks. So, you know, here comes the split decision. The day 27 on the life raft, here comes a Japanese bomber that's decided to use the raft as target practice. And so, split-second thinking, he dives over the wall of the raft into the water, you know, trying to avoid the bullets. He knows the sharks are down there, but he figures he's got a fighting chance with them. So he's down there in the water. Sharks are coming at him, and all he could do was put his arm out and just straight-arm the shark. He just take his hand and push on the shark's nose and push him away from him. And indeed, you know, the sharks, they have sensitive snouts, so they'd circle wide enough for him to get up and get some more air and come back down. And this little water ballet went on for about 30 minutes until that bomber finally left the scene. So it was just those kind of split-second decisions based on the knowledge that he had of what he can do that helped him through that ordeal.
Mm. Luke Zamperini is the son of Louis Zamperini, the subject of the recent film and blockbuster bestseller of Laura Hildebrand called Unbroken, and the author of a book of his own called Don't Give Up, Don't Give In, Lessons from an Extraordinary Life, published by Day Street Books. Finishing out today's morning show, we return to the conversation begun yesterday with best-selling author Domingo Martinez, whose most recent book is a frank and harrowing memoir called My Heart is a Drunken Compass, in which he recounts some of his very difficult and painful experiences while in the throes of addiction, and also talks about the very difficult and complicated relationship which he had with a woman whom in the book he calls Steph, a woman who was both mentally and emotionally fragile and unstable. Their relationship took a dramatic turn when she was involved in a very, very serious car accident in which she was nearly killed. You, of course, describe in great detail the harrowing experience of Steph being in this terrible accident.
Yeah.
And the long, long road of impossible recovery. And at some point, parallel to her suffering is a plunge of your own kind of into a emotional and mental abyss from which you are lucky to emerge. And at one point, when you are describing this moment just on the brink of kind of a breakdown, you said, maybe I could get my propeller started again as I plummeted. The idea that maybe it makes sense for me to just let myself go into this darkest place and maybe as a plummeting plane, maybe that's the only way to get things rolling again. Yeah. Again, I think you've done a wonderful job there in that small little moment of helping us understand why sometimes people do the things they do in these dark, despairing moments.
Yeah, it's the logic of exhaustion, alcoholism. I don't know. It really seemed logical. You know, I've been fighting it. I'm exhausted from fighting. The fighting it isn't working. Screw it. Let's just dive into it. You know, and at the time, it seems reasonable. And you know, and it's because you know your world is upside down and everything is backward. And the whole Lincoln Beachy principle, where he was a barnstormer in the early days of airplaning, aeronauticism, whatever it is, flying, the early days of flying, and he was the first person to realize that it went completely against a pilot's nature to turn the plane into the when there was a stall and they were falling. He was the first person to figure out that if you actually if you turned it against stall, I think it was the friction would get the propeller started again. No, sorry, it was the opposite way. If you turned it, the pilot's instinct was to turn it into the turn it against the stall, and the friction kept the propeller from igniting. But he figured out to turn if you turn in, you know, basically accelerate the fall, that actually allowed the propeller to go. And I heard this, and it was such a, for me at the time, and this is kind of the way my mind works, was such a perfect metaphor for what the situation I was in. It was like, you know, I was exhausted for, you know, 9 months I lost my job. I had to be at the hospital every day for, you know, 3 to 5 hours. I was dealing with her family, who at this point were, you know, tearing each other apart. So, you know, why not me? Because I'm in the mix too. And, you know, they knew that we had been separated, that, you know, I was basically just the guy that wouldn't go away. And I couldn't allow myself. I mean, that was, and it was, I wonder if, it was kind of a sort of a Greek tragedy in its own way, because, you know, we had been split up. We were officially disengaged, and, you know, I'd moved out and everything. And then this happened to her, but I just could not walk away from this. I couldn't in good conscience, no matter what it was doing to me, walk away from her bedside. And the only time that I was able to was when she was cognizant, she was talking, she was, they had moved her to a long-term care facility. She was able to communicate. She certainly, by, you know, no stretch of description, was cured or, you know, back to herself. I'd say she was at about 35 to 40% herself, but she was on the road to recovery at that point. And that was about the time where I was able to say, okay, you know, I've done what I could. and then it was time to start rebuilding my life again. And that's when the last part of the book comes in, where, you know, I met somebody who just completely changed my opinion about how healthy human beings can be. And she sort of provided, you know, the light, this other person, Sarah, which is actually her real name. And, you know, we went through a number of different code names for her, Catherine, Kathleen, etc. She never liked any of them. And finally, about 2 months before the book was published, my girlfriend, she's still my girlfriend now, she said, I think we should use my name. And so we do. But anyway, her I had met like towards the end of the relationship of, you know, after Steph and I had split up. And that started, and again, like, you know, all those crazy relationships happened. It came from someplace that it was completely unexpected, unplanned, you know, and it just all of a sudden, and I actually believe this, that no matter where you are in your life, the people you need are around you. You have to acknowledge that they're there. You have to realize that they're there. The right people will always show up.
Hmm. I think one of the most striking moments when you describe your friendship and what became eventually more with Sarah is at one point when you describe sort of coming back into her life, and you realize that as much as you missed her friendship, you missed her house.
Yeah.
You really missed, you write, the sanctuary and safety of being in a clean, sunlit place full of dog energy and Brenda Brown in the basement. The house itself is a destination, a place to go and sit with coffee and talk about everything and nothing, feeling a sense of safety that you couldn't say anything wrong. And neither would she, because we were both very clever and very raunchy in private and then very polite in public for the most part. I could get away with saying almost anything that popped in my mind. And Sarah would look at me like, did you just really say that? and then giggle, and I'd respond the same, and she would lob a particular astute or sordid bon mot, and we would have a wonderful time because there was nothing in the balance, nothing either of us demanded of one another. But that notion of missing one's house, I think, is so striking because it kind of says something about where we live and what we choose to surround ourselves with. I mean, it was no accident that her house was the place that it was.
Correct. Right. It was her. You know, it was her creation. It was the respect she had for her home, keeping it clean, keeping it the way that it was, and the friendliness there, and just feeling as if. Again, the word sanctuary just completely describes the environment. It was so much the opposite of what I was dealing with at the time in the greater Seattle area. I couldn't go anywhere without feeling some kind of a memory or responsibility back to Steph and the hospital, or I needed to drive her parents, who absolutely refused to take any advice about where to lodge. For long term, and so they would, her family would stay, completely across the city, where it would take them an hour and a half by bus to get there if they took the bus. But no, because I was there, I would drive them, and so it took me an hour to get them from one place to another. And it was the trauma just sort of descended on the city itself for me, and the one place I could go where I felt relief for just a moment was that house, and. And a lot of people felt that way. That was the beauty of the house. That it was in a wonderful part, a wonderful neighborhood here in Seattle, and the side door was open. It was let yourself in. Excuse me. Make a pot of coffee and sit down. Somebody's going to show up eventually. Well, the dogs are there. And dogs are very. I've been realizing more and more how significant dogs are in my writing. They're all through the Boy Kings of Texas, and they're very much here in this book. And in fact, I'm working on an adaptation for the Boy Kings of Texas for HBO, and dogs are basically the stars of the show. It's pretty funny. I think at some level I regard my relationship to my brothers very much in a dog pack.
Well, you have a lot of interesting things to say about relationship between brothers and relationships between frat boys and relationships between a lot of the complicated people that we encounter along life's way. You have once again crafted a really amazing, riveting memoir, this one titled My Heart is a Drunken Compass. It is published by Lions Press, an imprint of Roman Littlefield. And the author, Domingo Martinez. Domingo Martinez, it's been a great pleasure for me to speak with you about your fascinating book, and we're glad that life is in a better place for you now, but that you have written so well about what you have experienced up until now. We look forward to your further work. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Monday on The Morning Show, we're going to be hearing an interview which I just recorded with Jonathan Horn, a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and we do talk about that briefly in the interview, but we spend most of our time talking about Mr. Horn's new book called Robert E. Lee, The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, a fascinating book which draws very intriguing parallels between the figures of Robert E. Lee and George Washington. On Tuesday's morning show, I'll preview for you Tuesday night's American Experience documentary, which explores the incredible career of one of history's most important and influential inventors, Thomas Alva Edison. Wednesday of next week, I'll be speaking with former Kenosha Mayor Patrick Moran, talking about a new book which he has written about his own life. On Thursday, a conversation with Dana Kasperson, who has written a book called Changing the Conversation, which explores the notion of conflict resolution and some ways in which we can more effectively deal with the conflict in our lives. And a week from today, tentatively anyway, I'm scheduled to be speaking with a very fine singer by the name of Bill Hayes. Some of you may remember his name, I hope, from his years on Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar. He also was one of the stars of the original Broadway production of Rodgers and Hammerstein.